This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Last February, an ordinary day became extraordinary for whale watcher Michael Fishback. He was leading a boat tour off the coast of California when he saw something big. It was a dead whale, or so Michael thought. Then he heard this. The whale exhaled, letting Michael and his companions know that it was alive. He and others went to work freeing the whale from a drift net. They were successful. And what happened next was such an exciting moment that video footage of the whale rescue has been viewed more than 4 million times online. The whale leaped from the water not once but 40 times. It dove up and down for nearly an hour, putting on what appeared to those who were on the boat to be a splendid show of gratitude. Michael Fishback hopes to save many more whales before it's over. He's co-director of the Great Whale Conservancy, a nonprofit organization with headquarters right here in North Carolina, and he joins us from a studio at WCQS in Asheville. Michael, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here. Frank, thank you very much.
Millions of people, as I said, watched that footage of the whale rescue, but for those who have not seen it, tell us not everybody has seen that. Describe what it was like for you when the whale was freed.
Well, you know, after 19 years of running around various ocean waters looking at whales, to find one of these great whales, these animals that are made to move, trapped and unable to move, was really very shocking and sad. And to be able to have a hand in freeing such a magnificent life and watching this display afterwards was, I really think the best way I can describe it is, I felt like I became free. It was very connected, very fulfilling, very rewarding, and absolutely incredible to watch this magnificent life form swim off.
Let's stick with that connection for a minute, because what followed, even on that boat, was a sense, there's even an exchange between a little girl and her mother about what happened, the whale's behavior afterward, seeing it as an expression of gratitude. And you might say, well, that's a kind of thing that we humans do. We tend to project our behavior onto the animal world. But it does at least reflect, does it not, a sense of connection, a sense that we want to project our stuff onto them and feel the stuff they're feeling as humans.
Yeah, you know, I definitely think that we do. It is touchy territory to conclusively say anything about what an animal has done for, you know, a specific reason. I understand that it is touchy. But I'll tell you, when young humpback whale started really going at it with that surface display that we got after freeing him or her, it sure seemed like a bit of expressing the joy of life. And it sure felt like some of it was for us. It went on for over an hour with us in very close proximity. And yes, it did feel connected.
You lead boat tours off the coast of California in the Sea of Cortez every year. What kind of whale activity do people who join you typically get to see?
Okay, first of all, I should just minor correction. It's the coast of Baja California, or Lower California, which is part of Mexico. And we are there mainly for the blue whales. Blue whales are the largest animals on the planet, and in fact, the largest animals that have ever lived on the planet, as far as we know, including even the dinosaurs. They outsize the dinosaurs. And we typically see a lot of blue whales there in February and March. They migrate down from off the coast of California and other unknown places. We also see fin whales. We do see those humpbacks. We see other species of whales like Brutus whales and pilot whales and orcas and gray whales and lots of dolphins and sea lions. It's a pretty exciting place to go in February and March.
You were a professional tennis player in the 70s and 80s. How did you get interested in saving the whales?
Well, let's see. I think it really stemmed from another connected little story. Playing tennis was pretty stressful. I played 10 years on the pro tour. I liked to get away a lot and get out into nature and hike and even run up mountains and stuff. And when I was done, I moved to Vermont and started, in fact, a guided hiking business where we took our clients on hikes by day and put them in beautiful country inns at night. And we were pretty successful, and we moved out of Vermont, and we I put together a trip up in Quebec, and starting in old Quebec City and going down the St. Lawrence River. And the St. Lawrence River, believe it or not, has big whales in it because it has such a big estuary. So we would go downstream as far as the whales came upstream. And to make a long story short, I met some people that were working with those whales, some wonderful Quebecois people. And when I sold my hiking business, I started working with them.
Now, you focus mostly on the blue whale. Can you tell us a bit about that species?
Yeah, except I could go on for hours.
Well, we don't want we don't want Moby Dick here, you know.
No, we don't. That was Moby. No, well, Moby Dick was a sperm whale who had teeth. Blue whales have baleen; they have no teeth. So let's just talk a little bit about blue whales. Really, evolution at its most extraordinary moment, in a sense, or millions of moments. These animals are as big as 25 African bull elephants. They can grow to be 90 or even 100 feet long, although 100-footers are rare these days. They can weigh a quarter of a million pounds and go as high as 400,000 pounds. Their heart is the size of a Volkswagen Beetle and almost the same shape. Their tongue is 1,000 pounds. Their tail is 20 feet across, and it is an honor to both see them, in my opinion, and to share the planet with them, and an honor that I feel indebted to do more about, to ensure the fact that they are able to continue to swim the oceanic waters on Earth, because there's not a lot of them left.
Well, I was going to ask, how are they doing these days?
They're doing about the same that they were doing when commercial whaling of them ended in 1966. There really hasn't been a rebound for blue whales, possibly some minor rebounds in certain subpopulations, but not much. And we think, you know, probably one of the main reasons is that they are very specific eaters of krill. They feed on krill. In fact, they can gulp 3 to 4 tons of water in one gulp with krill mixed in, and then they separate the krill from the water by shooting the water through those baleen plates that they have in their upper jaw. So there's about 10,000 of them left on the planet. Before we started killing them, there were probably 350 to 400,000. So a Remian population broken into subpopulations in various parts of the world, genetics not being strong. But the strongest subpopulation in the world with the biggest numbers is the northeastern Pacific subpopulation, and the biggest individual congregations on the planet are off the coast of California right now between, say, July and October or November of each year.
Is there a threat to these animals, or are they simply not coming back very quickly?
I would say right now probably the primary two threats to the blue whale are, one is a little bit more difficult for some people to relate to, but it is a definite threat, and that is the acoustical threat. The blue whale emits the loudest sound of any animal on Earth, and the ocean is full of sounds made by humans now that haven't been there for most of the many millions of years that blue whales have been around, and we consider it a threat. A more direct threat to their physical body is the threat of being struck and either severely injured or killed by large ships in areas where the shipping lanes and the feeding grounds coincide. Number one worst case place on the planet is off the coast of California.
Can we live together? Are those threats, or have we advanced so far in terms of how we commerce and bring, you know, shipments back and forth, that we can actually coexist these days? Or is it an either-or situation right now?
It is definitely not an either-or situation. The Great Whale Conservancy, which I co-direct, this is our primary mission right now. It is a matter of moving shipping lanes in a couple of places off the coast of California, a few miles, maybe as much as 10 or 15 miles in some places, seasonally. That's all it is. Now, there's no question about the fact that this is not just simple. It's not like, you know, the blue whales get hit by ships, so you move the shipping lanes, said and done. It's a little bit more complicated than that. I don't think there's really enough time to get into all the complexities of it, but it is absolutely known what's going on, and it is absolutely fixable. It has been done with the right whale off the coast of the northeastern United States and eastern Canada successfully, and a massive decrease in ship strikes has ensued, and the right whale is recovering. The North Atlantic right whale is recovering. We can and we will get this done.
Is there much resistance?
Oh, much. Good word. Much resistance. Yes. Yeah, much resistance. There's been meetings for years. The shipping people don't want to do it. The politicians don't really have the impetus to do it. We have the model, we think, to affect the change. And that model is to engage the public. The public does not even know that there are blue whales off the coast of California, not to mention the biggest congregations of them on the planet. And we are going to make sure that they know, because we are in the process right now of constructing an 85-foot female inflatable blue whale that we are going to bring to public venues in California. And I have a funny feeling when we show up that kids are going to fall in love with that whale, and their parents are going to fall in love with that whale, and even the media might just show up to find out what that whale is doing there. And we're going to tell them what that whale is doing there. It's there to bring awareness to the people of California to put a stop to this carnage out on the water and help preserve the lives of some of the most magnificent animals that have ever lived on this planet.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about awareness being the focus of your energy right now. I mean, the Save the Whales movement, I think, was the icon. It was in the forefront of the ecology movement. You talked about 1966 being a victory when, you know, we stopped killing blue whales. That's how far back it goes. Have we forgotten? Where is that slogan now?
Well, here's my opinion on that slogan. That slogan came from the lovely songs of the humpback whales. When we discovered what incredible singers they are, we fell in love with them, and we wanted to save all the whales. The problem with those days was we didn't have a lot of knowledge about the different species of whales, their habits, their numbers, their natural histories. Now, however, you know, 40 years later, we have a lot of that knowledge, and we can see that there are problems in paradise with the whales, and some of them are very specific in certain areas, and other ones don't exist in other areas. And we have the ability to move more directly now to fix the problems with a greater knowledge base.
That specificity strikes me as interesting as well, because it seems to me the reason the Save the Whales movement took off the way it did and succeeded to the extent that it did was because of our attraction to the animal itself. It was a very attractive animal. It was an interesting animal. The movement itself has expanded to include these relationships. You talked about feeding krill. If you kill the krill, you kill the whale. What killed the krill? What else depends on it? It's those networks that we're all dependent on that strike me as even more important than our love affair for a seemingly a very intelligent animal. Is that becoming part of the message now, and is it being absorbed as the central message of ecology, that we're all in this together?
Well, you know, I am trying to do that, and I think it is being done. I mean, to me, as much as the blue whale needs to be saved, if in order to save the blue whale, we have to save, you know, or protect giant swaths of the ocean, which is what we need for our planet climactically and in other ways, and for all the other animals that live in the ocean. So to me, the blue whale not only deserves to be saved, you know, it is a keystone species that can help us to save many other things in the ocean.
Is that too complicated for us? I mean, are we dependent on the image of the charming and intelligent whale that says thank you for an hour? Or can we get to the point where those relationships in and of themselves, that we get it, that you know, if you kill the krill, we're all in trouble?
No, I think we can get it, but you know, there's certainly a certain percentage of us that aren't going to get it, that are going to want to save the whale, save the dolphin, save the coral reef, and they're not going to relate to the fish stocks or the, you know, the sea turtles or the seals or the krill or, you know, all the other very important things in the ocean. But I think enough of us can and enough of us will. There's some pretty big movements, you know, being enacted right now to help the oceans.
Later this month, you're hosting a fundraiser that's going to collect donations for the Great Whale Conservancy and Friends of the Bonobos as well. Do blue whales and bonobo chimps have something in common that's not obvious?
I don't know that they have much in common besides being some of the very important brains of their respective environments. I mean, bonobos are clearly incredibly intelligent animals, and blue whales are clearly very intelligent animals. This is, an honor to be a part of this event. It's being held at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences on October 17th, only because there's a director of that museum, Betsy Bennett, with the foresight to put an event like this together where two North Carolinians are working on keystone species of animals and really making a global effort to try to help them. This is going to be a phenomenal event, and I think one that will make any North Carolinian that attends proud to be from North Carolina.
Are there species of whales that are doing very well, and is there something we can learn about their success from their success?
I think that there are some species of whales that are doing well in certain areas. I mean, there's been some real rebounds, and I think we can learn from them. The gray whale in northeastern Pacific bounced back from the brink of extinction and now is doing pretty well. There's humpbacks and fin whales, the second biggest whales in the world, have bounced back from the days of whaling, unlike blue whales, to numbers that are probably 5 times to 10 times what they were at the end of whaling. But those animals are not specific feeders. They can adapt their feeding strategies much more than blue whales can. And we could have a whole nother show about, the acoustics of blue whales and how they communicate. And it's very, very complicated. But yes, there are lessons to be learned and they must be learned.
Michael, thanks so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Fishback is co-director of the Great Whale Conservancy. There's a fundraiser to support his efforts to save the blue whale on October 17th at the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. That event begins at 6 p.m. For more information, visit Benefit Whales Bonobos Charity Happenings.org. Or you can go to our website, stateofthings.org, and we can provide a link for you there. And you can also find a link to a calendar of events that are mentioned on the show. State of Things is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. Ginny Mueller is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. The managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.